Hello, and welcome to Scuttlebutt, the War Movie Review Podcast. We're happy to have you with us as we take a look at films from the dawn of cinema to today. We aim to provide a raw and unapologetic review of each film's cinematography, historical accuracy, and delivery. In the process of analysis, certain details will be revealed. These spoilers are only divulged to ensure a fair assessment of each film.
We embark on a great crusade this week with part one of our review of HBO's Second World War epic, Band of Brothers. As always, I'm joined by Mike A.
Hello.
Mike B.
Yep.
And Nate.
Hi.
Nate's been shafted by Lieutenant Silver this week. Yeah. So.
I was trying to remember what the fuck he says. He says, "Hi ho, Silver," but my brain fused because it's been a day. So, yeah.
Yeah, I understand.
So, what'd you guys think?
So, I think I'll just start this off because we've all seen this a billion fucking times. And I did refresh. I watched through it, you know, for the most part, right before we did this pod. And we've seen this, and it's obviously one of the most popular World War II miniseries that has ever existed, right? It was kind of the OG of that, and it was the, kind of the new era after Saving Private Ryan and whatever. And they had some good advisors on there, and they took their time. They actually cared about historical accuracy, and they were working with so many different factors, like the book, you know, Stephen Ambrose wrote, and then, you know, offshoots of that. And it's like, okay, how do we just tell the story of this one company of guys who were in World War II and whatever? And it's a very difficult task to kind of take on, because how do you tell that story? Through film, like, it has to be accurate, because these guys are gonna be watching this, and if you fuck things up, it's gonna be definitely called out. But also, you want to portray it accurately, but there's a lot of limitations with filmmaking that you can't really, you know, there's a lot of things. Anyway, I first watched this when I was, I think, 11 or 12 years old, right after it came out. And it was funny because my social studies teacher was the one that was like, yeah, well, you would like this. And he suggested that I go rent an R-rated freaking miniseries from the local video den, is what it was called. And so I did. And I rented it and fell in love with it immediately. It was like, oh, this is better than Saving Private Ryan. This is like so much more storytelling with it. I get to know the characters more and everything like that. And nowadays, it still holds up because it's like you get to know all the people who were actually there, and you get to know the characters and what they went through. And this first episode, I think it did as good of a job as it could have for only being an hour of describing the training, they actually getting over to England and then doing more training there, and then actually when they pre-embark to Normandy. And I think that the casting was very well done. In hindsight, I've seen a bunch of, disclaimer, I've seen a bunch of like behind the scenes things and whatever, and I'm like, yeah, it's pretty cool. At the time, I was just like enamored by it, and it was amazing. But it still does hold up. There are some little technical errors, and there's some things in the, you can't put everything into an hour, and we know that. We've all tried to do that, and we can't do it. But overall, I think the episode was pretty decent at showing just the very basic experience these guys had after basic training when they were going through airborne school, which it was a new thing at that time. And it was an elite school and everything like that. And yeah, it's very interesting. So Mike A.
Yeah. Obviously. Yeah. If you're into World War II movies and just war history, like you, of course you've seen this, and you know, it's I think HBO had wanted to do this for a number of years, but Saving Private Ryan was like the stepping stone that made them say, like, that's how we should do it. That was the one that actually, like, where they said, we should get, you know, Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, like, look what they did here. That's how we want this to be. And that's kind of what led to it actually getting made. What's interesting though, is that this show, it was not like a major hit initially. It came out, this episode one premiered 2 days before 9/11. And, mm-hmm. And then after that, with everything going on in the world, like, it was not the, a giant hit at first, you know, with all of the, you know, crazy political and, you know, shit going on in the world and all, you know, the country and everything. And later on, like, I don't think I knew about it until I was like maybe 15 or something. And they started playing reruns on A&E. I remember episodes, you know, completely edited and with, you know, the thing where they would fill in the swear words with other words and stuff like that.
Yep.
And, something that, you know, our generation, you know, loves that sort of thing as a, you know, humorous little thing from the past. But anyway, and then I eventually, when I was in high school, you know, got the whole thing and I watched it, and yeah, it's great. Like anything, if you want to pick apart little, you know, errors and things that, you know, you don't like about it, you can do that, definitely. But this first episode, I think, is really interesting. First, I've never really seen a thing that really covers, you know, the buildup of a unit like this, you know, from this war anyway, from this specific war, especially something like, you know, an airborne unit, which, like you say, was new at the time. And now, because of how popular the show is, you know, people kind of associate World War II training with this episode, you know. It's the casting, in my opinion, is really good. I freaking love David Schwimmer in this.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. I remember, you know, watching some behind the scenes stuff with him, and they were like, you know, what was it like going, because he did the basic training with all of them, all the actors, because they did that, you know, like with Dale Dye. And they said, you know, I mean, did they all just see you as like that goofy guy from Friends? And he said, yes. And that's exactly how I wanted them to see me. I wanted them to resent me. You know, all the actors. I think David Schwimmer is an underrated actor because I've seen him do other stuff.
Yep.
You know, he's freaking great, man.
Very good.
And,
yep.
Yeah. And he carried, you know, obviously, what's his name? Is it Damian Lewis? Is that the?
Yep.
The,
that's Winters.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Winters. Yeah. Obviously he's the lead, but in my opinion, this is like David Schwimmer's episode. I mean, he carries it and he's great. And just showing a flawed individual, you know, just this guy he's good at something. He's so good that it's like to his detriment almost. And, you know, being a fucking asshole to these guys, you know, and training them so hard and everything like that, it's eventually his downfall. I think it's a really, just to make this even longer, I think it's a really good episode. And, yeah, I'm going to pass it on to Nate.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I don't know who mentioned it, but the one thing that, I was in the same boat where I'd never really heard about Band of Brothers until I think about 2002, 2003, because the only way you had HBO is you went to your rich friend's house who parents would actually, you know, pay for it. And, you know, my parents definitely were not going to do that. I don't think we even had cable until like 2002 or something like that.
We're not going to let you watch that porn channel.
Right, exactly, yeah, it very much was, it's very, yeah, HBO is where all the softcore porn,
Skinamax, yeah,
yep. Yeah,
yeah, HBO is where all the softcore porn was, but, you know, it's interesting taking a look back at it, because, like, to me, in my formative years of knowing this, it's like, this was the only thing I knew that was, like, an episodic, and I always thought that, you know, this was I thought this was like the first kind of trend for that. However, there is another series called When Trumpets Fade, which is an HBO, I believe it's an HBO funded series as well. And to my knowledge, before I knew about that series, I thought like the only thing close to that would have been like Sharp's Rifles, where it's like an episodic, but Sharp's Rifles was like a movie released with another movie and released on the movie. This wasn't like an episodic kind of marketed thing. And so this being like the newest point of this was, it's very interesting to look at the trends and stuff. But like When Trumpets Fade, I believe Trumpets Fade is like so not known at all.
It's also really bad.
I haven't seen it. I just know it's bad. And
I tried to watch 5 minutes of it and I couldn't do it.
Yeah, gas explosions with
they all fuck the
oil
same
oil cans. Yeah, they all what?
They all fuck the same prostitute.
Oh, okay.
If you want to share the same chick with like six of your buddies, have fun. You know?
Okay, is that what that whole series is about? Is that what you mean?
At one point, yeah. It's
okay. So my point is like, you know, the only thing we had to compare that to was guys who fuck all the same prostitute. So for me, this series, it really is the launch of an episodic kind of formula in that sense of success. And I think that is very interesting to look at it as a sense of like, it's a TV show technically, but it's just like the miniseries stuff, at least to me, never really was very much around until this point. And I think it does a really good job of, as an overall, if we talk about the overall thing just real quick, I think it's very interesting and very impressive that you can have, you know, I think it's like up to 7 or 8 directors total for the whole series, have this, can hit the ball constantly on every episode. I think that's very good. This episode as itself, though, to chime in what everyone said, you know, it you know, focuses on the training aspect and all that kind of stuff. And I think it does it very well. It definitely sets the bar for that type of cinema. And I'm very shocked and very sad that you did not mention Hacksaw Ridge has the best camp scene interpretation, Mike A. I'm very
Nate, you know what? You know, we're in the tradition of busting laptops. This fucker's about to go through the window right now. I specifically didn't want to, but no, I mean, it's funny. When I was watching it today, I was thinking that, like, oh, the fucking training scene at Hacksaw Ridge is so stupid. Compared to
right.
This.
Yeah, you don't want to be naked and throw knives at your buddy's feet and
stupid.
Are you
Vince
Vaughn? Yeah.
Vince Vaughn's like, I'm going to be David Schwimmer in this movie. I'm a funny guy and I'm going to be taken seriously now.
Well, it's funny, you know. You mentioned David Schwimmer. It's like the same thing for me. It's just Friends, because I used to guilty pleasure Friends all the time. So like for me, it's like,
I don't think we can be friends anymore.
Huh?
I don't think we can be friends anymore.
Yeah.
It's okay.
But no, I mean, like, it's very interesting to see him in this. It's also really cool to see, like, you know, the starting of a lot of these actors' careers and all that kind of stuff within the series. You know, Michael Fassbender, Simon Pegg, like a bunch of others. And it's just very interesting to see it. But, you know, not to repeat everyone else has said already, I think it's a very good episode. I think it nails down all the markers, and I think it definitely set a precedent for the last 10 to 15 years of interpretation of camp life and starting a movie and or a series. Brian.
Nothing else to say. This really was not the first military series by any means. I mean, they started really in the 60s with Rat Patrol. And Rat Patrol turned into MASH, and that turned into Tour of Duty and China Beach in the mid-80s. And then, like you mentioned...
You also forgot
Combat. Yeah, I was going to say Combat.
Combat. You also forgot Combat. One of the bigger ones. And there was a bunch of other small ones as well. But that turns, you know, into the 90s, like you said, mentioned, Nate, with Sharp's Rifles and When Trumpets Fade. But Bob was really, you know, the first one to take it seriously. Have a boot camp. You know, go the extra mile and really bring a lot of the movie aspects of making war films into the TV side of things, you know, and that was the real crossover. Because after that, you get The Pacific, Generation War, you know, Our Mothers, Our Fathers. And today you have, you know, Masters of the Air. So.
And Generation Kill as well.
Well, that's Generation War.
No, Generation Kill about the Iraq War.
Oh, that's the problem. Generation War and Our Mothers, Our Fathers are called the same thing. That's the thing.
Yeah, I get that, but it's Generation Kill is also another great series.
I thought it was Generation War because stupid American marketing, but yeah, that's another series that's out there.
Yeah, it's all good.
And
yeah, no, Generation War is amazing.
Yeah, it is. So, but it's just interesting how it's just this new wave of everything, you know, coming out, and it really did set the bar very high. You know, bringing Dale Dye into the mix and stuff. So it's interesting. And this episode as well is just, it really sets the stage for the series, you know? And, you know, like Michael had mentioned, it did come out 2 days before 9/11. What I thought was interesting, I always thought the first episode came out, but they actually released Day of Days as well. So it was a 2 episode that was dropped. So you kind of really get, you know, a gist of the series just on the first release, with the training and Day of Days. But this episode alone does a very good job to convey, you know, the lead up to Overlord and just the composition of a company as well. So it's just, it really marks a turn in serious, you know, television. Because you got to think about it at the same time. You have The Sopranos. You have a lot of other things, you know, out there. And it's like, for the first time, we're going to take the Second World War and do it very seriously. So,
to rephrase what I meant to say, was that to me, Band of Brothers definitely upped it, like took it in the next level up, which is exactly what you said. And when you said it, I'm like, oh yeah, we're right. There is TV shows with all that, but like to me, it's like that's such a generation before. So like for me, I think it's like more of like, I guess what Brian said is like, and to reiterate what I said, it's like the bar is raised to a certain level of degree of quality and stuff. Because you look at combat, you look at all the older TV shows, and it's like it's TV show quality of the time. And it's like this is a movie in an episodic form, which I don't think just really happened that much prior to Band of Brothers. I mean, tell me if I'm wrong. Sharp's Rifles and stuff, but
well, like I say, I mean, because the book was written in 92, I'm pretty sure HBO wanted to do this for a little bit, but SPR was like the one where when that came out, you know, SPR set the bar for everything at that point when it came to World War II, you know, video games and, you know, movies as well. And it was like they saw that and it was like, no, that's how we want to do it. Like that's because I don't know if it was the, you know, before that, it's not like World War II was a hot, you know, commodity. But then once SPR came out, it's this huge fucking success. And I mean, the way it was done and everything, they were like, hell yes, that's how we want to do it. So the SPR, I think, is the catalyst for a lot of, you know, the stuff with this and, you know, the Pacific as well.
Well, it definitely is like, I guess, like you said, like the catalyst to prove that is financially a good bet. Because,
yeah.
I mean, how much did SPR make, you know?
Oh, I mean, it was like the biggest thing in the world. I mean, I was only, like, 8 years old, I remember, you know, hearing about it. It was, like, the big thing that summer, you know. Big Spielberg movie. But this, I'm glad that, though, that with this series, it's not the same kind of thing. I mean, clearly they wanted to you know, capture a lot of the tone and the, you know, do a lot of the techniques to make it, to pull it off like they did with SPR. But with this, you know, I never really felt like I was watching a copy of SPR. And SPR has a lot of really good American actors in it. This show has a lot of good American actors in it as well, but it has a lot of great British actors as well.
You exactly.
Know? Yeah, and
yep.
It's like, I think that this was a great series to let them shine. I mean, I'm trying to think, you know, Damian Lewis, obviously he's British. The actor who plays Liebgott, he's also British. And he's great. Yep. And they all like their accents are perfect and you buy them completely. And it's also great because, you know, being British, a lot of these guys at the time, anyway, when they were younger, you know, there were probably a lot of theater actors and such like that, not really well known. And, you know, it really makes it even more believable because you're not just like, oh, that's such and such actor, you know? Because that's one thing that a lot of, you know, when you try and watch something and take it, it's like, well, I'm just seeing this actor because I know him from a bunch of things. But all these guys, I mean, it seems almost like they're plucked right out of history, you know, and you can just see how seriously they took this and how dedicated they were.
Well, in the casting itself, like I watched a little bit about how they did it, and they looked for the physical features of the original people. And then they looked for actors, and then they were very meticulous in their casting process, and it shows because when you look at like pictures of the original dudes when they were the age that these guys would have been, they're very very close. But they also had to have the same mannerisms, the same accents. They actually so SPR was just kind of a fiction. It was based off of a true story, of course, but like. It was more, there was more liberty to be taken with the fictional part of it, right? With this, it's like, no, you're literally telling the story of real people who will watch this and still exist at that time. And you cannot fuck this up. So that's why I think a lot more research from every aspect went into this, whether it's the equipment, the accents, the mannerisms, the the height and weight of each soldier, you know, whether it's an officer or enlisted, it doesn't matter. Like, they really studied and worked with, like, Stephen Ambrose, which I have some reservations about him, but that's not neither here or there. But, like, they studied the people, the actual people, and they were like, what did you do? Like, how would you move? How did you talk? How did you talk back then? Is it different now? Blah, blah, blah. They really got as many details as they possibly could. And they didn't get everything, which you can't. It's impossible. Because it was fucking, at that point, it was 70 years back. Or no, was it, no, it was 60 years back. Well, almost, yeah, 70.
60 something.
But yeah, it's 65, we'll just say. And it's like, yeah, it's impossible. But like, they actually put in the time and effort to get the mannerisms, the way that people talked, and everything like that in the actual series. So, well,
there was, just to chime in on something there, you know, with the whole behind the scenes stuff for the series as a whole, it's like, this is the first, at least to my knowledge, that they were able to get the real guys to talk and interact and form a relationship, yes, with the actors, yep, on top of that. Like, these guys had, you know, in-depth relationships and friendships with, you know, these veterans, and it's like, it's very rare that actors could form that bond. And I think for the most part, those actors, most of them, the ones that the veterans that were still survived at that point, were able to form those relationships and really, really kind of nail down.
And they were very hesitant at first. Yeah. I was watching this thing the other day, actually, about who's the guy that plays Bull Randleman?
Oh, yeah.
He's a very...
I know who you're talking about, but I can't remember his name.
Michael something, I think.
Michael, I forgot what his name was, but he was talking about when he first called Bull Randleman, and his wife answered. And he's like, yeah, I've been cast to, you know, portray. And he wanted to know, hey, what was your thoughts? And then Bull was very, very apprehensive at first. And he's just kind of like a very direct person. He's like, yeah, all right, well, okay. And then the actor was like, did I just fuck that up? Like, what? Shit. What did I, you know, what did I do wrong? And then he started forming a relationship with him, and so did the other actors. That's a good point. It's like they got past, because basically, like, what a lot of the guys from Easy Company thought, from what's like empirically deduced from my own like research on the shit, is that they were like, oh, they're just gonna fuck this up. It's Hollywood. They're gonna fuck it all up. And the actors were like more scared of the veterans than they were of this job. They're like, I just want to get it right. Please just you know, work with me. And like then anyway, I think that's what helped out a lot, because In this first episode, you literally get what the army is. You get guys from all over the fucking country, way different backgrounds, different ways of speaking, all that shit. You get it in one place for one common goal, right? Some of them are like, oh my God, I can't do this. And you see that, but you get that. And they're, it was so well done in that respect. I don't think really any other film has gotten it that well done. Film or miniseries. Pacific maybe, but that's because they use this as a model. But I'm saying up until this point, like, I don't think any series or movie had gotten that as well done as they did. What do you think, Brian?
As far as like cohesion between the men?
And just like the difference, like the cultural, like, you're still an American, but like the different regions and everybody, you go through basic and then you volunteer for this fucking
The Boys
shit
from Company
show.
C.
Yeah, that's a bad one.
Yeah, from the late 70s. That does a really good job, kind of show the different dichotomy of Americans.
But I think it was a lot more watered down.
Oh, for
than
sure.
This,
but that's the closest thing that
episode
kind of comes to it. Besides having the guy from Brooklyn,
it, you know.
And the guy from Illinois, and the guy from the Midwest state.
It doesn't seem very cartoony, you know, whereas I don't really,
No, it's just real.
I'm from New York. Like, let's beat those Nazis. Like, I have some reservations with Masters of the Air fucking dialogue.
Oh.
I'm really good. Beat the goddamn Nazis.
And I'm not really a fan of The Boys in Company C, but that's a whole other thing. Whatever.
Oh, well, you were in D Company, I know. So, you never liked the C Company boys.
talking about, you know, the actors to the veterans and stuff. It's like, you know, like Buck Compton, Dick Winters,
Carwood Lipton.
Carwood Lipton, Babe,
Garnier,
Babe, Heffron,
Percante.
Yeah, like, dude, like, these guys were. It's insane though, because it just hit me. It's like 12 to 13 years old. I say it with hesitancy because I feel like, oh, it's just like you jump on the bandwagon when you're 12 to 13 years old, like, you know, doing this. But like these guys, I really looked up to them in that sense. It was that pulp culture craze of, like, you know, they are, to me, I was like, holy crap, like these guys are insane. But just down the road, I have a veteran down the road who's been my neighbor for 15 years. And like, I never talked to him. Like, he could also be just as revered and stuff like that.
Himmler's bodyguard.
Right. And like, unfortunately, really good job. Unfortunately, he passed like around that time. But it's like, it made me think, like, the thing is, it's like, you know, the guy down the street could be easily the same here, but like these guys were to me. And as much as I love that, I also hate that because I feel like my neighbor should have gotten that respect as well. But to talk about like just reverence, it's like their story was brought to light and I was like, holy crap, you know, like this is really good, you know. And
that's one company out of one battalion, out of one regiment,
right,
out of one division, right, that fought in,
right,
the Second World War.
And that's what I mean. It's like these guys, like every World War II veteran at the time should have been revered just as highly as they were. And I think it did bring awareness to, you know, these guys at this point in time. And, you know, but at the same time, it's like, I am happy that those guys were the guys who I was really wanting to look up to and research and knowledge and look into interviews and all that kind of stuff of the real vets. But at the same time, it's like I cringe going like, ooh, I joined the populace of the early 2000s.
Show that launched a million reenactors.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
My grandfather used to say, you know, every vet needs to be remembered because the man behind the man behind the man with the gun. I think the ratio was that for every one GI in the front lines, there were 8 guys behind the line supporting him and making sure that everything got there.
10, I've heard.
Yeah. Yep. So like, it's just, most of combat arms guys are a very small percentage of the veterans that are out there, you know. And that
combat arms consists of like 5% of the military. And that's a very large,
like,
number.
I know some historians that have done some hardcore research on some very popular like World War II memoirs that are paperbacks. And half the time, I shouldn't say that, like a good 20% of the time, it turns out that individual was a replacement and showed up after battles they said that they were in, or they made up stuff. And, you know, D-Day to VE Day vets are rarer than hen's teeth in 45, you know? So it's just, history is a funny thing. So yeah, every vet needs to be remembered regardless of what they did. A cook in fucking Leavenworth or a fucking paratrooper in Bastogne, like, you know?
Dude, cooks, army cooks, they actually portrayed that in this episode very well. Those guys were, when I was in, and from everybody I've talked to that went through, like, in Desert Storm, Vietnam, Korea, and World War II, the cooks work their goddamn asses off. And it shows that, and that's why they have this thing called KP for combat arms guys that are in training or out in the field, because they need help, because they're so overworked. Cooks, they sleep for about an hour or two a night, and then they're up cooking again for 200-300 guys a day minimum. And it's like, what the fuck, man? Those guys are fucking insane.
There was when we did GAP all those years ago, for a lot of consecutive years, I had two or three guys who wanted to do army cooking reenacting in that sense. And the reason why I mention this is this reason alone. We had the old KP halls at Fort Gap before they restored them and did all this stuff. So this is like, you know, the asbestos and the lead paint was still around in your food. And we did that whole thing. And dude, KP, like, just chiming on the episode of how they actually show, you know, the mess hall and all that kind of stuff. Exactly the same layout in at 40 in Town Gap. Exactly yep. the same building, everything. And we were finding we had trays from 1940 still there, and we were using them for our mm-hmm. for our mess hall and everything. And even as a reenactor, those guys were amazing because they would literally stay up till about, I don't know, 9 or 10 at night, still close down the KP, get everything sanitized, go sleep for about, I don't know, 3 to 4 hours, and then wake up immediately and do it all again all day.
Yeah. You have to. Yep.
And it's incredible. And those were just reenactors, so I can't even imagine. And that was for, you know, maybe 60 to 80 people. I can't even imagine doing it for, you know.
It's insane.
Brian.
Yeah.
So speaking of food, back in the day, I used to volunteer at this museum, and it was in the late aughts, early teens. And it was fascinating because you really never knew who would walk through the door every day. And this was at a time where veterans, World War II veterans, were in their late 70s, early 80s mostly. So you got some really cool guys. And we had a few paratroopers walk through. We had one 508 vet walk through one day who was a 30 cal gunner through, I think, fucking Holland at the end of the war. He had some neat stories. But one day we had this guy come through, and we were a tank destroyer museum. So we, you know, specified in tank destroyers. So we had a lot of guys that were tank destroyers that wanted to come to our museum. And he was a tank destroyer vet. But he had tried to be a paratrooper. He'd washed out of the course. And it was the thing that pissed him off the most in his life. Because the way he washed out was very similar to what they show in Band of Brothers. It was like 3/4 of the way through, and they had a big spaghetti meal for everybody. As much fucking spaghetti as you can eat for anyone. And then after the meal, they went on a 5-mile run, and anybody that threw up was thrown out of the course. And he threw up. Yep. And he was fucking so mad. So mad. Like, so mad when he went to Europe, he got a jump jacket from somebody. He went to Italy. He was in the 601st, and he wore it for his whole time in Italy. And he had the photos to prove it. And whenever he ran to any of like the little subordinate units that were in Italy from the 82nd or stuff, they would give him shit. He'd be like, fuck you. And he literally, so he had a fucking M42 with a TD patch on for his whole career. And he was a really funny yeah. guy. It was his biggest fucking like, fuck you. I'm not going to, it's not fair. So, to that day.
But that's the thing is, like, at that point, the airborne was elite. And they were like, you want to be part? It's like Rangers are nowadays. Actual Rangers, like tabbed and scrolled. The training is not easy at all. It's grueling. SF, same thing. But Rangers, I've talked to a lot of SF guys who were Rangers prior to going SF. And they said that, yeah, the whole Ranger school and everything kind of came from airborne guys in World War II that kind of boiled the training over to be that hardcore. And like, if you wash out in any capacity, like throwing up on a run, you're fucking done. And that's kind of, you know, it's gotten watered down over the years, but yeah, go ahead.
This is really funny. This is something I came upon recently in my research out of the blue. So yes, Ranger training had its influences from the Army Paratrooper Corps, but it actually had bigger influences from the USMC Raiders at that time. And Raiders mm-hmm. were actually sent to U.S. Army camps in the East Coast early 42 to help set up the Ranger training camps. Basically, they had gotten their training from the British, but in a very big way, the 75th K Company Rangers owe their existence to Marine Corps Raider tactics. From that
right. Well, here's the thing is my point is like all those units back then, we say elite now. Back then, it's like, again, you throw up on a run, you're fucking done. That's how hardcore it was. It's like, it's hardcore now still. I don't want to minimize any of that shit over the years. But in World War II, my God, like, and they showed a lot of that in this episode is like, it's fucking tough, man. Dude, because here's the thing. 3 miles up, 3 miles down may not seem like anything to nobody or to anybody who's not ever run a mile in their life. 3 miles up a fucking mountain, a gradual incline, you'll be destroyed. But you'll get there. It's the way down that fucking kills you. And it's fucking insane. And they're doing PTs one day and they're doing boots and utes or boots and uniforms, like their gear, basic gear, the next day. Dude, it's, you have to be so incredibly physically fit and mentally fit to do that shit day after day after day. Just that one aspect of the training alone. We're not talking about, okay, you made it past here. Now we're going to fucking learn how to jump out of actual airplanes. I mean, yeah, being physically fit is one thing. Mentally fit, I guess. You made it through that. You didn't wash out. Now you're going to learn how to jump out of airplanes. You're going to hurt yourself because every time somebody jumps, I've got a lot of airborne friends through the different decades, and all of them say every time you fucking jump, you get hurt. Every fucking time you jump, you get hurt in some way. It's just a matter of if it's a bruise or a couple cuts.
Or like that. But you, or like that hurt. Modern guy who smacks into like a fucking excavator recently that's going around the internet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or you get a cigarette roll. I mean, there's a fucking million things that could happen.
Yeah.
No, but that's the thing is like every airborne guy that I've ever known in my life has, they're like, yeah, every time you jump, you get hurt. It's just a matter of taking the pain and going on with it and not fucking letting it affect you.
Like, just quickly, like in the movie A Bridge Too Far, they show very awesome large scale, you know, paratrooper operations. And they show Gavin hurt his back. And that really happened.
Yep.
Gavin hurt his back, and they think that a lot of the bad decisions he made were contributed to the fact that he had a fucking sore back for the whole
time. He's in pain, well, he can't fucking think.
You know? Same with Vandervoort, who's depicted in The Longest Day. You know, he broke his ankle
landing
in Italy, and then it healed, and then it broke again when he landed in Normandy.
Yep. Yeah. The famous guy, he was wheeled into a cart on St. Mary Glees.
Yeah.
Or a hand cart.
Well, that's what my whole point is like, it shows the training. Like, okay, they've already been through basic army training. Then they go to this, which is an extension of that. Back when it was like an extension of that, it was longer back then, but now they've got it into like a 3-week time period. But okay, so you get through that shit, you volunteer for this, and then it's just an attrition rate that's insane, right? Okay, yeah, you washed out, you did this, you did that, whatever, or you didn't do this, you didn't do that, so you're done. And then the guys that get past the initial physical fucking torture, which is what it is, then they go to airborne school and they actually jump out of planes. They do their 5 jumps, okay, with all their shit on, and then they get their wings. Well, now you're in a fucking unit that is an elite unit. The training never stops. It just keeps getting worse and harder because you made it this far. We're going to keep going. And
well, I was just going to say, and then you have a guy who is a hard ass.
And he's a very good training officer. Not good practically, though.
And just to touch on the whole elite training thing never stops. It's kind of funny they touch on that in the movie Battleground from 1949 in the beginning. Because, you know, by that time, the 101st Airborne had just been doing nothing for like 6 weeks to 2 months. Just, you know, they were going to go to Paris for Christmas. And it shows them doing the really crazy fucking marches, like split steps and this, like the like stuff that you really have to have time for and just do a billion times, like, you know, ceremonial kind of stuff. And the two replacements that show up are like, holy shit, like those guys really know how to march. It's like, yeah, you know, it's like, well, yeah, we're the airborne and we got the time and we're not going to be shut up by anybody. So just keep applying that and everything. And also to bring up another point you had, this thing I wanted to talk about. What I like about this episode a lot, and again, it happened in reality, which is funny because not a lot of times you have things in film that depict reality. So, you know, truly, is that there's a difference between a really good training officer and a really good field officer. Very rarely do you have a jack of all trades. And there's no shame, in my opinion, of not being good either or, you know, because you can say what you want about Sobel and how much of a dick he was. But the training showed at the Battle of the Bloody Gulch. Easy Company was the only unit that didn't break. Everybody else broke their line, but they didn't. They held. You know, time and time again, the hard training of Tekoa shows through with Tekoa men throughout their campaigns. Like, you know, within 6 months, they have D-Day, they have Market Garden, and they have Bastogne. It's fucking insane to think about the turnaround time. Every 2 months, there's this big, huge operation that they've written thousands of of books about, you know, and these guys live through it. So that hard training they got from Sobel did pay off, despite the fact that it was horrible to go through, you know, and that he was a horrible combat leader. Thank God he was taken out before he could really kill anybody.
Right. That was a good decision.
But, you know, there is something to that. Like, you know, it a respect in a way to what he did, how he did prepare his men for the future. But on the backside of it, we're not always who we want to be or chart ourselves out to be. And ended up with this, the same thing happened in the Pacific that happened in real life. What was it? Sidney Phillips's lieutenant during the Battle of Alligator Creek fucking just locked up and didn't do shit. And they show that in the first episode of the Pacific, how the guy was just like wheezing and doing nothing. And it's like, again, you can pump yourself up for it. You can get yourself ready for it. But until you're in that instant, you don't fucking know what's going to happen. Nate.
I believe it was Buck Compton who went on record saying that he didn't particularly like the interpretation of Sobel on the miniseries, and that he credits the same thing like what you said, just credits to the even though he was such a pain in the ass, that he credits them for keeping them, most of them, alive through that whole entire experience with all the training and all the stuff that they had to do. Because he said, I think it was like, he saw so many replacements die that didn't have the intuition and that training and all that kind of stuff that made it, you know, really do that. And, you know, it could also be, you know, hindsight. Oh, I don't like how they interpreted him. But, you know, I think that if a veteran is saying that, you know, they're not doing it for any particular reason. It's they truly believe that, so.
No, I agree, because it's so Sobel. So in World War II, like, people are listening, I know you guys know this probably, but like in World War II, yeah, your officer was your in charge of your training. It was like late World War II and post World War II, and during Korea when they really came out with the drill sergeants, right, or drill instructors for the Marine Corps, and it's like, okay, they do this thing, but it was very aggressive, it was very vicious and mean. Like Sobel was, and very fucking nitpicky. Just everything keeps you on your fucking toes constantly. And they found out, because Sobel wasn't the only one. There was a lot of other officers that, or who led their men through training, and then they went to combat together and blah, blah, blah. And they survived because of the amount of intense, shitty training that they had to overcome actual combat, right? And so that kind of philosophy was carried over after the Second World War. And they went, well, we're going to make NCOs, who are usually very experienced, the core of our training program. And we're going to make it aggressive and vicious and shitty. So that when and if these guys get into combat, and even if they don't, they'll still be prepared for it. And they portrayed, you know, again, David Schwimmer did a fucking awesome job, because physically, like looking at him and the actual Captain Sobel, very, very strong resemblance. Also, Schwimmer, like, he fucking portrayed an officer that was a piece of shit. According, like, not like, you know, I say a piece of shit, like the guys were like, fuck this guy, you know? Like, and that's, you know, when Nixon said, you don't know a guy that would double time Curtis two times with a full pack just to piss in that guy's coffee. Well, there you go. You've got a common fucking enemy. And that's kind of how they transformed military training after World War II into going, yeah, these drill sergeants and drill instructors are going to be the fucking enemy of the people who are in training. When you unite them against them and they don't want to fucking, they just want to stop fighting amongst themselves, and they've got this guy that's making their lives hell, well, then they're good. Because that's how war is. So, anyway, go ahead.
In a way, I do feel bad, though, for David Schwimmer. Because of the nature of the role. Why is that? He's awesome in it. But it's a role that we only see for the first episode. In a way, he does so good in this one that I kind of would have liked to see him in a combat role throughout the rest of the series. But that's me being selfish from an actor's perspective, not from the role's perspective. I would just, you know, again, to turn a guy from Friends into that, it would just be really interesting to, you know, see how he would be under, like, you know, a real, like a Karen Tanner or something episode, as far as his acting and everything. If he can really deliver, you know, not just in a training.
As far as acting, you know, yes.
Because it's just such a great transformation. It's just, you just don't see it.
In that case, David Schwimmer did his job perfectly because you always want to leave the audience wanting more. And, you know, I think that he fulfilled the role. He played the role and went beyond what it was probably expected. He did it perfectly. And I think, it's a very memorable performance.
I loved the season they're in the field in like North Carolina, and then they were in in England, and he's out in the field. It just shows him like he's like profusely sweating. Nobody else is, and he's like again, great training officer.
Horrible, combat.
Not a great.
Well, I love also leader. Too. It's like every decision, every time he turns around and like tries to give an order, like it shows the guy, and they're just like.
Right.
They just know this guy sucks.
Take these guys and
right. Well, and also you can tell that he knows it too, because like they keep doing these things where it'll cut back to him and he's like quietly to himself going, "God damn it," you know. And it's just like he knows that. Oh yeah,
he knows. And
is there a problem, Captain Sobel?
Well, is there a problem here, Captain Sobel? Yeah. But here's the thing is, I think, honestly, I've read The Biggest Brother, right? And so I've read that whole thing about Dick Winters. I don't think he would have been a good training officer, to be honest with you. I think he had too much compassion and he was just too analytical to be able to, like, be the yelling, disciplined guy. But he's a great combat leader, okay? And so I think there was a reason that the universe lined those two guys up to be kind of frenemies, because Sobel was a great training officer. Winters was a great combat leader. Again, like you said, you can't be both. Usually you cannot be both. Now they've proven that wrong in the recent years, because most of my drill sergeants when I went through were combat veterans and they were really good leaders as well. But at that time, everything was so fucking new and convoluted, and coming off of the First World War, the interwar years. Okay, let's figure out this shit, you know? And I think that at that time, there was a reason that those guys lined up and they were in the position they were. Because they really quick, Brian, that company could have taken a lot more casualties than they did without having that insane training officer doing their training and making their lives a living fucking hell. So.
It's interesting, too, because if you want to talk about fate and everything, the luckiest break that Winters ever got was not becoming the commander of Easy before D-Day. Because if he had gotten what he wanted, he would have been killed. Because that whole plane of the command staff and part of the battalion staff was shot down. It was the only, it was one of the, I think, the biggest regimental losses on D-Day for the 101st. They lost a whole plane full of officers, basically. Yeah. You know, it's interesting how things happen. And Easy is there. In my opinion, at 2 points where it had to be there. First was Bloody Gulch, because that was very important. You know, the German counteroffensive to retake Carentan. If that had
let's hit that when we get on that.
But this ties into the training though. And secondly, you know, they don't show it too well in the episode for Holland, but they stop a very important counterattack where they basically blow up one German tank on a very narrow road that stops the 12 Panthers from coming to this bridge, the Sohn Bridge. So. Mm-hmm. Again, it shows their mettle. You know, it shows that when Winters needs to dig in, he can, and he can command his troops. And that all comes back to, you know, this training in Georgia.
Well, what do you think about my opinion of Winters? I don't think he would have been a good training officer.
Depends, because he was never tried like that. So it's hard to speculate.
Right. And there's some people that just have that natural knack for it. And I don't think he... It's nothing against him, because again, he's a great combat leader, but I'm glad that, like, and again, like when you were taking a piss, like I was talking about, like, this was not the only company at all throughout the entire war that had a fucking rigid training officer. Rigid. They tried to do it in Hacksaw Ridge, didn't work out, not good. Fuck that. But like, I think Schwimmer, you know, playing Sobel was really a good representation of a lot of those, like, 42, 43 training companies, especially elite troops.
The only other thing I could think of from the war was the 10th Armor Division. It was commanded by this fucking hardcore super Quaker who would like charge people if they swore. And he was very, 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 very by the book. If you read his memoirs, he was very by the book. But where do they end up? They end up at Bastogne and Noville in the beginning of the Battle of the Bulge. And they do an amazing job pushing the Germans back and holding what they can. So there's one great story. These guys, they're fighting for like a few days and they get blown out of their tank and they're walking back. And all they have between them is like a knife and a hand grenade. And they run into a German soldier that wants to surrender. They're like, I don't know what to do. But they had a really rigid commander the whole fucking time. And when those guys got into it, they held and they did their job. That's not really saying anything, but that's the only other case I could think of from the war where like you have a super dick who trains his men and actually it does convey later on.
But he was also there with them. That's the difference too. Is like,
sure.
Sobel got transferred to that, you know, the school at Chilton Foliot, but like, which is where he should have been because he's a good training officer. And, you know, but I think the episode represents, or it not represents, portrays, the amount of, because when you're doing training like that, and it's fucking just like, what the fuck are we doing? Why are we out on a fucking march? All the other guys are sleeping. You're like, I'm singled out. This is a personal thing. Like this is fucking retarded. And then when you realize that they're trying to do this, so when you get into a combat zone, your life is actually more tolerable because you've experienced that amount of stress. You know, you go, oh, okay. I get it now, but you know, cause it's that's a, you know, like my drill sergeants always told us like at the end, they're like, the reason we were so fucking hard on you guys is because we've all been there and we don't want to see any of you guys on a casualty list. We don't want to see any of you guys get fucking killed. We want you guys to like learn everything you possibly can and be the best that you possibly can and not ever get fucking hurt or killed in Iraq or Afghanistan. And that whole mentality goes all the way back for a good leader, you know, a good training leader. And I think Sobel was so scared himself, from what I've read about that, he was so scared himself that he wanted everybody around him to be able to fucking function perfectly, even though he could not, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like,
and it might've seemed too that he was given a company with the easiest name and
that's pretty funny, Brian. But
in a way, it's true. I mean, knowing some military commanders, because it can be a, oh, you guys are an easy company, it could be an inside joke. And to get ahead of that, then
oh, yeah,
you got to be a dick.
Well, it's also an ego thing. Like, he strikes me as, like, from what I've read about him, like, he strikes me as a guy that wanted to just make it as high as he possibly fucking could in the military and just fucking, you know, do his best. And it's the same way today, like, Your troops and their performance reflect on your evaluations, and it was true at that point as well. And so he probably was one of those guys that was A, scared, B, just had a knack for fucking yelling at people and like find, because here's the thing, you can yell at people all day, but if you actually find things like he did in this film, like, oh, you got rust in your fucking bayonet, okay, you're done looking for any excuse, but it's a valid excuse. It's like that actually takes skill to like find little tiny details while you're in charge of an entire fucking company.
How would he have enough energy to win the war?
Yeah. Or when he's like, I want 6 infractions in an hour. What do you mean? Find them, you know? Like, so while we're on it too, just the uniforms are great. Nothing really to complain with there besides the spades, but that's a story for our next episode.
I had a problem with the helmet liners.
Well, let's hold jump stuff until day of days.
I want 6 infractions, Brian.
Oh, no. I'm talking the liners in training. I don't care about jump liners. I'm talking about the actual helmets they had. They didn't have the fucking rivet in the front.
I think at least one of them did.
There was 2 that I counted. There was 2 that I counted that had that.
Well, I wanted to come because like I think this is a really interesting thing because you see a lot of stuff that you don't see in, you know, a lot of war. You see like these HBT coveralls and
that was fucking real. Yeah.
And the like the M3 what's it called, diaphragm gas mask,
yeah,
bag
kidney bags.
Oh yeah.
Like Those are cool. Yep. Like, it's real early war shit. And yeah, a lot of them, in that first right, scene, it's really interesting.
Sorry, Michael. There are 51 helmets.
I also think they had steel cap canteens for the most part, too, in the training thing. I can't remember.
Steel caps?
1910?
Yeah, they had the early ones.
Aluminum cap? Yeah, that's fine.
Not 1942
Well, okay. Okay. Rivet counter. Okay.
They're called Model 1910.
It's not a rivet counting thing. It's the Model 1910 cap was actually flat, but 1917 cap.
No, I know. I'm busting your balls. You're fine.
Oh, but Model 1910 cap.
Yeah, no. That's perfectly accurate. That's
no. I know it's accurate. Yeah. I just think it's cool that's even the thing. If I'm even remembering that correctly, it could be.
Meanwhile, we went on a crusade to find flat tops for our movie.
Right. Yeah.
I still have them. It's awesome.
Some interesting things, though, with like some of the guys are wearing just M41 field jackets too, in that like that first scene where they're all lined up.
No, they're wearing HPTs. They're wearing
No,
a couple of the like Lipton has on an M41 field jacket.
Huh.
Yeah.
Does he?
Some of them do, and some of them have the regimental like insignia sewn on their chest. It's really weird.
Let me see this.
Well, on the A2 jackets, yeah, they would do that. That was the thing officers did as far as the...
But a couple of them have... There's like one or two guys or three that have like the khaki M41 field jackets on.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean with the insignia. They did like to sell their insignias on jackets like that. Maybe for training it wouldn't be exactly correct, but that was a thing with the 101st. Right, because you see a lot of A2s with the officers in original photos. But Mike is totally right, though. Those are M1951 liners without the insignia hole. So it's very...
Would they be that color?
Yes.
Dark
for the color is fine.
That's just...
Yeah, they're a little darker, but like it passes.
They look more like St. Clair liners because they had a very dark color versus like the Westinghouse.
Yeah, and but like they didn't have the fucking the rivet hole in the front. They're 51s, yeah.
They would have originally, you know what they would have had? Holly liner, paratrooper liners.
I know
things that don't exist anymore.
Well, so when you say the hole in the front, does that mean for like putting rank insignia to the front?
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, Mark Malarkey is the only one I can
all
see.
All World War II liners.
There's Malarkey. There's a guy behind.
I think Winters has it too.
No, he does not. It's Randleman's got another one. Randleman has got a hole, and there's another random dude in the back.
And that would just be only for like lieutenants, right? For putting the bar and the
fucking thing. Sergeants, if you're a corporal or above, like, but they had that in there for that reason.
You put corporal?
They made
really?
School insignia. Yes. It never really happened, but that was the idea.
Huh.
And it was. Yeah.
And you find some liners, some original like World War II liners. With corporal pins on them, like in that.
What
that
I love is that
interesting.
So
I didn't.
They're
know that.
Made for pinback insignia, but not everyone had pinback insignia. So a lot of times you'll find that guys that will make another hole, so that when they use their you put it through and everything, it's pretty funny. Or times you'll find like a guy was promoted and he'll have like a lieutenant bar, and then it'll be an offset bar to the side because he became a captain, but he didn't want to repaint the first bar.
Yep.
It's a lot of funny things with ranks on liners and helmets and stuff. But long story short, the pre-51 liner. Didn't or had a hole, and then in 51 they redesigned it and they said fuck it, we don't need a rank insignia, you wear your helmet anyway. So
going back to the uniforms, like just looking at this right now, a lot of the majority of them are wearing the HBT coveralls, but some of them also are like Percanti's wearing the two-piece HBTs, and then like Lipton has the M41 on. So it's kind of interesting that there is like a little hodgepodge of different uniforms and such.
Bit of a mix. Well, that was all stuff that was there that was used in training at the time.
Right. And okay, so I don't know anything about these, but like in this show specifically, like the officers are like in this first scene, like Sobel has this brown leather jacket on, and Winters occasionally
has
one on too.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Is that just like an officer thing?
It's a flight jacket. Yeah, and a lot of the officers in the 101st would wear them because they were private purchase. And they wore them all throughout the whole war. A lot of officers in all units, like even 2nd Armored Division guys, I have photos of them having private purchase jackets that they wore, out and stuff. It was an officer thing because you could buy anything at the PX. They're very stigmatized that they were used by air crews, which they were. But, those jackets did end up in the hands of infantry officers and stuff for behind the lines kind of shit. Allied lines, obviously. But,
I also love how before, they... Like the first half of the series, they have the what are they called? The the ground forces patch or whatever, the red, white, and blue patch.
Oh, yes. There. Yep, because they're in the States.
Yeah, like that's a they don't have the 101st patch on the entire 101st time, didn't like exist. The first half of this.
It was all individual.
I know, yeah. Yeah. It's just a really, it's just a good detail.
The other one that's nice too is that the white name tapes, because name tapes are not very much associated with the Second World War, but they were very much a thing in training. And well, yeah, just mostly in training, but it was a thing the 101st did a lot, especially before they went into Normandy. And you actually do see a stencil as well used on uniforms that does show up in combat and stuff later on. But the white name tapes is really cool. And if I'm not mistaken, I think one or two of them actually did end up with high ranking officers in Normandy. Like they just kept them on, but it was a training thing. And it was just really awesome to see both in the States and also in Europe, because again, you just don't associate World War II with name tapes. But it definitely happened a lot more than people think. Just the one side too. No U.S. Army, no, none of that bullshit. It was just name, like the name tape.
What kind of boots do they have? When it shows them actually in their PT gear running, what kind of boots are they wearing?
Type 2 service shoes.
Okay. Because, yeah, they're definitely not Corcorans.
Yeah, the boots are something that you earned.
So right. There's a big story behind that. They're not paratrooper boots. They're tanker boots originally. And then they got turned into paratrooper boots. And for the whole war, there were fights between who could wear paratrooper boots and who couldn't. And famously, you know, if paratroopers won the bar fights, they would cut the top of your boots off. And they turn them into service shoes. that was a big thing during the war.
That's kind of nuts.
And this guy who was a washout, he got paratrooper boots. And again, he would literally like, you know, yell at paratroopers and be like, I earned this, but you didn't earn this. Like,
there were 29th Rangers. There was a program prior to D-Day and they wore paratrooper boots. And I remember reading an account or seeing picture. It was one of the two, but like a guy who they had, pretty much what happened was they were going to do a 29th Ranger, but like regiment, but it didn't pan out. And so they just integrated them into the unit. And so then you would see like a random guy who has jump boots versus everyone else. And normally that was a guy who went through the Ranger program for the 29th.
Well, it's interesting. People love to talk about that, like during World War II, you know, like the paratrooper boots, you earn those and stuff like that. But it's funny, like on D-Day, Army engineers and Navy guys, they wore paratrooper boots too.
Right.
Like, yeah. So it's something that, like, yes, yeah, yeah, it's a thing that the airborne, like, we earn these, but like other guys would.
If they had them, they would have used it. Right. You know?
It's what the Navy on Omaha Beach, like, had a lot of paratrooper gear. It's weird. A lot of them have, like, M1A1 carbines and such, you know, paratrooper boots and such. It's just sometimes that stuff would filter in other places.
A bit of foreshadowing as well, but later on in 44, when double buckle boots start to show up and you can't get paratrooper boots anymore, a lot of the older guys wouldn't give up their boots because it was a status symbol. Because it was like, oh, right. You're one of the old school paratroopers versus, oh, I have a pair of brand new boots that everybody has. So, you know, right. It's funny how even in the Corps later on, the paratrooper corps later on, it turns into its own kind of status symbol. But after the war, they go back to a black Concord jump boot. So it's right. Funny.
One thing that's also like Sobel's attire in this, so I already talked about that jacket, but at one point, and I remember this is mentioned in the book, when they're in England training, he's wearing like this big ass leather jacket that like you'd see Pat B3. Wearing. He also, Sobel doesn't ever seem to carry like a primary weapon. He always just seems to have a sidearm during training.
He's a major or captain.
Yeah, but like even like Winters later on when he becomes a captain, he has like an M1 and shit like that. I mean, you think that once he got, if Sobel got into combat, would he have like a M1A1 carbine or a Thompson?
He would have an M1A1 usually, but then again, remember the mindset of this individual. This is a guy that knows how to train people really well, but when the shit hits the fan, where are you? He's not there. Yeah. And he's not going to equip himself for what he needs. Like, even like you're saying, he's wearing a fucking bomber jacket in the field.
Yeah,
this man
in the field,
you know, like with a 45, like that's stylistic choice. That's not an optimistic choice. So
anytime it shows them doing training combat, he just has his M1A1, you know, M1911. I mean, excuse me, in his hand. I never see him carrying like a rifle or anything.
And you know,
so
guys that are in charge of companies, like you know, officers like that, they can make those types of decisions. You know, if they really don't want to carry a long arm versus a sidearm. But again, it just goes along with the character that he's just inferior for his position and just, you know, making the wrong calls as somebody in that position would be if they're making the wrong calls, you know, because what the fuck, you know, obviously he's a talker. His job isn't to shoot. If you want to get really technical. But at the end of the day, you still want to have a means to protect yourself besides a sidearm. So,
one thing I also wanted to talk about is when we do finally get to the preparations of D-Day. Now, Brian, did you say to me at one point that these guys actually, like E Company and, you know, 101st Airborne, they actually did not use a lot of scrim in the helmet, or was I wrong?
No, you're right. So there's not a lot of evidence that Easy Company had spades on their helmets.
Okay.
They did. Oh, it's very particular. It goes down to even battalion level, but apparently 2506 did not use a lot of spades. They didn't use a lot of nets. They didn't use a lot of scrim. Meanwhile, 3rd Battalion 506 used a ton of scrim and nets, and I think only the 1st Battalion used a ton of nets. But if you look at a lot of photos of the 2506 before they went to Normandy, they really don't wear nets. And something interesting.
Yeah, we see 2506 in Normandy, they have nets and scrim on. Which is weird. So,
but it even goes down to platoon level. I mean, there's some really crazy, like, Band of Brothers reenactment research that has been done. But as far as I can remember, nets and scrim were not very common within the 2nd Battalion of the 506.
Yeah. Especially I like the detail of the you know, the smeared face and all that stuff. The
chalked up face.
Yeah, it's just, you basically, well, it's not chalk, it's burned cork.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So you do is you just light cork on fire. We still do it today, mind you. And you just char it, and then you rub it on your face, mix it with your face oil.
We used to use ash from fires, but it would just give you pimples.
Gross.
Right. No, if you use cork, it doesn't give you pimples. That's the whole trick.
I like the Mae West is also a really cool detail.
Yep.
It's a little yellow in my opinion, but yeah, it was neat. Because they're a little yellow orangey, but that was the one thing I noticed this time around. I was like, ooh, that... It looks more like a prop than it does actually Mae West, watching it for like the 100th time. But
yep, and that's one of those things that, like the fucking scrim, like the fucking lack of the fucking rivet on the front of the liners for rank, you can forgive that because everything else was pretty much spot on. That was a good
call.
Pretty
well done.
Well, the other thing that you can say really is, you know, niche that's wrong is most of the carbine handguards are 4 riveted versus 2 riveted.
I did notice that.
Correct carbines as well at the same time, M1A ones. So
another thing that I love seeing is that you see occasionally the M7 rubberized gas mask bags on their legs.
Oh, yep.
You know, yeah, that's a thing that they would, instead of putting them on the chests, they put them on their legs.
Especially post-jump, that was a really nice, convenient way to carry it.
Well, we also still carry them on our legs if we're carrying them. So
yeah, carry the mop suits and shit.
It's very fun.
Most guys, like in 29th ID, they'd wear them on the chest. But yeah, first
for
ID
for the invasion,
for the invasion, yeah.
Oh, are you talking about the rubberized gas mask? Sorry, I went to take a piss.
Yeah, you can see them on their legs. A lot of first ID guys wore them on their legs, like the paratroopers. But mostly you see them along.
Those bags are really annoying. I have two of them.
They were so annoying,
but they're great.
The fucking bra, but they're great to put your wallet and your phone inside when you have to run around.
they would just fucking throw those things.
I have a photo. It's funny, like the assault vests and the assault gas mask bags show up sometimes later in the campaign, but I have one photo from like mid-July where a 4th ID guy's using one with a backpack. And I'm like, that's a really good idea. Other than that,
a waterproof backpack too, because it's waterproof.
He did the straps as a, you know, just up down like you should instead of crossed, and then just wore it like a backpack
instead of wearing it like a bra like we all do.
It was like a rubberized 45 pack, literally. Like
that's the really size cool. Of I actually that's a really good idea. Actually,
it was some from footage like the push to Saint Lo, and it's like I have a photo of it somewhere, but it was cool.
Maybe I'll do that.
Navy engineers would put a lot of their deck cord and stuff like that in those gas mask bags.
Makes sense.
It's waterproof.
So talking on like on gear and stuff, maybe you guys said when I went to go take a piss, but I love Toy's fucking rant of how much shit he has to carry. That scene. I've loved it ever because it really does put into perspective how much fucking shit he's having to carry.
And most of the shit they just shit canned as soon as they landed or shortly thereafter.
This bullshit. You know? And a pair of nasty skivvies.
Yeah.
And the leg.
He mentions One thing that's kind of interesting is that he mentions a Gammon grenade.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know too much about those. I've never really heard much about them.
Oh, come on, Mike. Yeah. They're the Gammon grenades that look like ball sacks in Medal of Honor Airborne. I'm surprised.
Listen, I've played Medal of Honor Airborne, but it's probably the most unrealistic depiction of World War II.
You mean a contact grenade?
Yeah, even though, like, I mean, you can take out a Tiger tank with three of them, but, you know. I love that game. It's so dumb.
It is very
dumb. It's so much fun.
While we're on
dumb.
The subject of dumb things, for this week's sticker trivia. So I think everybody listening to this knows who Dale Dye is. Dale Dye has been in the industry, Hollywood.
Larry King.
Yes, Larry King's best friend.
Yeah.
But, you know, advising war movies for the last, I don't know, almost 40 years now. But this week's question has to do with Mr. Dye. What was the first movie he was ever in? And to give a hint, it wasn't a military movie. So the first person to send the name of that film to our Facebook or Instagram gets this week's sticker.
Very cool. One more thing. If we're still talking about, you know, technical shit. One thing that's kind of interesting is that you get the scene where the British soldiers show up in German uniforms and such to kind of familiarize them. What do you guys think of that stuff? Do you think that like, I don't know, to me it looks like a little too perfect, the uniforms. Like, it looks like, you know, reenactors.
Let me go.
The Brits had the most advanced counterintelligence operations of the war, and they knew the most amount, the most intimate facts about German soldiers than any other allied nation, and they did have units that did stuff like that. To the point where they would show up at, like, an American bases and only speak in German the whole time. The Americans had a similar equivalent that they would do things like that, where they would also tailor make uniforms and things. But those guys were mostly in the States. And those were from immigrants that, like, you know, had come from Germany and stuff, but they were American citizens now, whatever. Yes, it did happen 100% to that detail. Why would they be walking around the Membury airfield, I think it was, you know, before the invasion of Europe? That doesn't really make sense to me for recognition. I think they should have shown up earlier in the training, but the Brits 100,000% did shit like that, to that detail of the German soldiers looking at that, walking around. I just felt like, yeah, that it was a little out of place. And for 20 years after I saw it, until recently, when I'd be like, that's strange, why are the German soldiers there, even as a kid, until I found out about this whole thing where, like, yeah, the British heavily invested in trying to, you know, show how the German soldiers looked, how they acted, you know, how they lived to their own troops.
So they actually didn't fly in for the invasion. They were
walking around to show all the Americans what Germans look like.
They're I'm looking at the still frame right now, and it's not good.
It's only there to show that the one guy wants to get a Luger really bad. That's the only reason that's in.
No, I get it.
Yeah, malarkey. Yeah.
Well, I remember it's mentioned in the book. They say that, yeah, there's Brits in German uniforms walking around to familiarize the guys with what the enemy looked like. And but in my opinion, when I saw it, I'm like, this just looks a little like too on the nose. I don't know.
It's not on the nose, though. It's
it wasn't
really
Milwaukee, by the way. It was Hoosier.
A Hubler.
Hoobler.
Hoosier. Hoosiers from the Pacific.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is then. It is then kind of fucked in terms of trying to depict what a German soldier looks like.
Right, but here's the thing: is that could have been very historically accurate. Because
that's
the
what I'm saying.
Not have, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it's like, it's just kind of like, okay, they're wearing gray and they got the helmets on and they've got guns.
Right.
So here's what to look for. Basically, but the Panzer guy actually doesn't look too bad, to be honest. Mm-hmm. He's got his wrap on, the EK2, EK1,
low boots with Gamaschen.
Yep, Panzer Assault. Well, he's probably got Panzer boots on, which did not have hobnails, which is interesting.
He's got the Gamaschen on.
Yeah, I know, but he might have just had Panzer boots on. I don't know. I couldn't fucking see. But, like, yeah, he's playing an SS fucking... I can't see the fucking cuff title on the guy. So I don't know what unit he was trying to portray. But, yeah, anyway, this guy's shit's all fucked up. It's originally M40 helmet, which is nice, but it's way too small for him.
Right.
Anyway.
But on that note, I think we can move into final thoughts.
Yeah, like I say, I think, you know, this is a great series overall. But, you know, as episode one, before we got on this, Nate's like, this is the most boring episode. It's like, hey, I think this episode is fucking great, you know, as an intro.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. And
I don't say I don't like the episode. It's just It's just boring.
I know. I think it's great, you know, on many levels. And the writing is great. The acting is great. You know, all the stuff we've talked about. So as an intro to a series, I would give this a 8 out of 10.
Decent.
It's interesting. Like, I don't think I've watched Band of Brothers in probably about 6 years now. So going back for this has been, it's going to be a lot of fun kind of going through and doing it the way we're doing it. Overall, I mean, it's like Mike said, or Mike A told, or kind of ratted me for, it's like, you know, it's boring. It is boring. It's boring comparatively to the rest of it, because it's just when stuff gets going, but it doesn't mean that it's a bad episode. I think it's extraordinarily good for what it is. And I enjoy it. Even though I think it's boring, I still enjoy it a lot, and I can sit there and watch it. So, to make a long story short, I like everything that is in it. It's a good start to the whole series. I think I'm going to give it like an 8 out of 10 Screamo Gibsons for this one.
Yeah, it's a really good intro to a series. And again, we've talked about this a million times on the pod before, but like, if it's overall really good and well done, well executed, well acted, well written, as best as it can be, because again, you have an hour to portray 2.5 years of these guys' lives, right? You can't really do that, right? And I know I get the whole thing, you're crunched for time, but you still did the best, or they did the best they could within that hour to kind of explain the training and the process and blah, 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 blah. And the few minor technical things, I'll forgive that. Does not matter to me. It really doesn't. It doesn't take anything away from it. It's not egregious. And so the acting was, you could see these guys were new to this, but they fell right fucking in because of that boot camp that they had. They fell right in. They were acting. The body language is like soldiers are, right? It's not this overdone, stiff, rigid shit. It's like, no, fuck, goddamn, we got to go on another fucking march. Why the fuck are we out here? What are we doing? God damn it. You know, and they're all trying their best and whatever. And I really love that aspect. And I think like, was it Brian said earlier, like Dave Schwimmer, I don't think they could have cast a better person to play Sobel. I really don't. He just fucking fell right in and just did it, and did it very well. And it shows, like, yeah, he's got a lot of strengths. He's also got weaknesses. That's what every human has. And it was really well portrayed, and he did a fucking phenomenal job. The weaponry, good shit. Overall, the training, the food, the chow hall, the training environment in general just sucks. It's hot. There's flies. It's just nasty. And then, yeah, it's a very good transition at the end, too, to Overlord. They get on the planes, and all you see is the planes flying off at the end. And you're like, okay, well, there's something about to happen here. So I really like this a lot, and I'm going to give it an 8.6 out of 10.
Yeah, I mean, all I could add is that this series really revolutionized, you know, military television series, just like SPR did for movies. Made it a very interesting time when a lot of awesome television was being made, and we're still living in the reverberations of this series to today. I mean, it's one of those things where it's hard not to watch whenever it's on. And I think all of us have seen it on Spike or History Channel or something throughout the years. I mean, it's really cool that it's on Netflix now, because it just opens up to much more of a broader audience that can watch it. Yeah, you know, that being said, this really opens it up really well. It's excellently cast. It's excellently done. Besides the fact they used the wrong helmet liners, which I can't unsee now.
oh, sorry, dude.
give it a 9 out of 10. So it really starts off the series on a very good foot, and quickly, you know, keeps the pace going for the whole time. And adding up our scores into the calculator that will tell us if we will be able to successfully invade Hitler's Europe, we get a score of 8.4 out of 10. So
pretty damn good.
I think that might be the lowest score that we get for the rest of the series, but you know, it's
could be.
It goes without saying that this is in prime time watching category. You know,
yes.
This is the first time you've heard Band of Brothers, I don't know why I've made it this far into this episode without watching it. You're stupid. But yeah, fucking Bob is awesome. and we'll slowly be chipping away at it this year.
And just so that everyone knows what we're kind of be doing with the score wise, we're going to individually rate each episode as we go along, and then that cumulative score goes into the final score for the whole entire series. So just so that people are aware how we're going to grade it throughout the grand scale. Once I get off my fat ass and fucking do all the giant list, because we're almost at 100. So
very, very close. So anyway, we will catch you guys next week.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Great!
We fall upon the risers. We fall upon the grass. We never land on our feet. We always hit our ass. Highly tidy, Christ almighty, who the hell are we? Zim, zam, goddamn, we're airborne infantry.
Whoa.
Hey!
Hi, ho. Fuck you, Nate.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to leave a rating. Otherwise, Mel Gibson won't stop screaming. If you like this content, make sure to check out our Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram pages. If you want to directly support our work, make sure to check out our Patreon. All these links are in the description below. Until the next time, Scuttlebutt out.